BBC News.
And now on BBC Radio 4, in the first of two programmes on nutrition, science and lifestyle, Dr. Ben Goldacre explores our past and present fascination with food and health in the rise of the lifestyle nutritionists.
Food has become a modern obsession, and we're constantly bombarded with miracle cures and sinister, hidden scares from the world of nutrition. Bacon causes cancer. Fish oil pills will make your child an angel. But where do these ideas come from, and are they really based in science? I'm Ben Goldacre, and over the next two programmes, I'll be examining the real science behind nutrition, how we can know the risks and benefits of different types of diet. But more than that, I'll be exploring how this evidence has been used and misused by the lifestyle nutritionists. They present themselves as men and women of science, but is this true? Or can we find their roots in the health gurus who've sold their patent medicines for many centuries? Anne Anderson is author of Snake Oil, Hustlers and Ham Bones, a history of miracle potions, quack remedies and the American travelling medicine shows.
A lot of the influences came from the Italian Commedia dell'arte, so you would have a character who was modeled pretty much on the Italian dottore character. He would be in long robes, and he would have a very solemn air about him. And he was called a mountebank, which literally means he who jumps on a bench. And he'd get up in the public square and, you know, get himself in a place where he had a little bit of height. And he would start to proclaim his wares. The principle of entertaining people in order to make a medicine sale was something that just came to them instinctively.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Do you wake every morning in shame and despair to discover your pillow was covered with hair?
I don't know if your listeners have seen Sweeney Todd, but there's a very good example in that show of an English quack, the character Pirelli, who's actually an English guy who's pretending to be Italian, and he has with him his Mary Andrew, his little assistant, who comes out before the show to kind of puff him up, to kind of prime the crowd.
Does Pirelli stimulate the growth, sir? You can have my oath, sir, 'tis unique. Rub 'em in it, stimulating in it. Soon you'll have to thin it once a week.
Patent medicines really took off in colonial America. And what's striking is how similar these characters were to our own modern diet cranks. The solutions to your woes were always commodifiable in their magic diets and potions. They were fascinated by anything exotic, Dr. Lin's Chinese blood pills and Hungarian balsam. They were obsessed with sticking things up your bottom. And, like our modern diet faddists, they were eager to make sure that everyone perceived themselves as ill and in need of professional help.
How much is your health worth, ladies and gentlemen? It's priceless, isn't it? Well, my friends, a shilling is all it takes to put you in the pink. That's right, ladies and gents. For a few pennies, nature's true remedy will succeed where doctors have failed. Only nature can heal. And I have nature right here in this little bottle.
In the 19th century, especially the early and middle 19th century, nobody knew anything about medicine. So you'd get these guys up on a platform and they would be saying things like, if you go to a doctor, he's going to take out your tweedium. Well, there's no such thing as a tweedium, but that, you know, never mind. Nobody knew anything, including the doctors. So there was actually a reasonable rationale for taking a patent medicine. The patent medicine makers understood something that advertisers have been using ever since. And by the way, I love this quote from George Orwell, which is, advertising is the rattling of a stick inside a swill bucket. Well, these guys could play that swill bucket like a symphony orchestra because they understood that what good advertising does is that it creates the problem and the solution. So they first would scare the bejesus out of you, and then they would tell you how to fix the problem.
Some of the health food products from this era survive even today. Graham crackers were invented by Sylvester Graham, the first great advocate of vegetarianism and nutritionism as we would know it. He was also the proprietor of the world's first health food shop. Like his descendants today, Graham mixed up sensible notions, like cutting down on cigarettes and alcohol, with some other rather more esoteric ideas which he concocted for himself. He warned that ketchup and mustard, for example, can cause insanity. Graham's health food store in 1837 heavily promoted its food as being grown according to physiological principles on virgin, unvitiated soil. Was he talking about chemical fertilisers? No. This was soil which had not been subjected to overstimulation by manure. But Graham's ideas were taken even further by the great John Harvey Kellogg, the man behind the cornflake. He was a Seventh-day Adventist, a surgeon by training, and opened a sanatorium in Michigan, where wealthy clients engaged with his strict vegetarian diet, as well as some of his more exotic and strange rituals.
What he did was just cram tremendous amounts of water and plain yogurt through either end of his patients. He had a machine that would pump 15 gallons of water up his patients in a matter of seconds, and they would have to endure that several times a day. And he claimed that keeping yourself squeaky clean would cure cancer of the stomach, ulcers, diabetes, schizophrenia, manic depression, acne, anemia, migraine headaches, and premature old age.
Kellogg was a Puritan and a vigorous anti-masturbation campaigner, recommending painful surgical procedures to prevent self-pollution. But the true father of the modern alternative health movement was Bernard McFadden. He updated the model for contemporary moral values, selling his granola bars as a food that would promote a muscular, lustful lifestyle. He combined esoteric ideas from naturopathy and osteopathy with sensible notions of vegetarianism and exercise. He changed his name to sound more like the roar of a lion, from Bernard to Bernard. And he ran a phenomenally successful magazine called Physical Culture, featuring beautiful bodies doing healthy things.
At the other end of the age scale, Bernard McFadden, veteran physical training merchant, is preparing to give his physique a new sort of test. He's going to make his first parachute jump.
I expect to get the thrill of my life. And remember, I'm 81, but still I'm a young guy. Don't forget it. Goodbye, folks. I'll see you when I come down.
McFadden was a poor orphan from central Missouri. As a child, he suffered from tuberculosis. He visited several doctors. He tried all the patent medicines, and none of them seemed to work.
New York journalist Mark Adams is author of a forthcoming book about the life of McFadden.
Around 1883, he stumbled into a German gymnasium in St. Louis and saw all the men working out and began to read some of the health literature that they had in the library there, and was sort of brought up to speed on the health fads of the day, which included those of Sylvester Graham, William Blakey, who was sort of a strong man out of Boston, who wrote a book called How to Get Strong and How to Stay So, and fads like hydropathy, sweats, internal cleansing. So he took these ideas and ended up at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, where he witnessed Eugen Sandow, the great German strongman, probably the most famous athlete of the 19th century, and he was so blown away that he decided that he was going to start his own magazine and called it Physical Culture. Physical Culture was an enormous immediate success. There was really nothing like it at the time. It was the first mass market health and fitness publication. This is at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, and he's running articles on, you know, vegetarianism, weightlifting, fasting, colonic irrigation. There was a slogan at the Physical Culture Hotel, which is a sanitarium he purchased in upstate New York in the late 1920s, which was that you will leave the Physical Culture Hotel clean inside and out. He never took it to quite the degree that John Harvey Kellogg did. Kellogg was sending all sorts of liquids up the business ends of his clients. McFadden was strictly a waterman. That said, I met one of the few surviving employees of the Physical Culture Hotel, and he told me that the standard first stop for anyone arriving at the hotel was a visit to a man known as the Rear Admiral.
Bernard was a shrewd marketeer and keenly aware of his brand image. Weakness, he declared, is a crime. He exploited bodybuilder Charles Atlas to sell his programs. Before he died, aged 87, in 1955, he'd opened various institutes, giving out PhD-style diplomas, and he'd even started a religion.
He is sort of this godlike figure to alternative medicine, naturopathy, osteopathy, chiropractic, all these things were given a huge boost by McFadden and, you know, brought under sort of one big tent for the first time, and essentially formulated diet and exercise as it's popularly known today and made it accessible to a mass audience. And I think that's probably his great legacy. I mean, alternative medicine as we know it today owes an enormous debt to Bernard McFadden.
If the history of diet cranks had ended with Bernard and his healthy lifestyle, even allowing for the funny ideas, then all would have been well. But the myth of the magic potion refused to die. And in the mid-20th century, the great American medicine show was to have one last hurrah. Haddockon.
Down in Louisiana in the bright sunshine, they do a little boogie-woogie all the time. They do the Haddockon boogie.
There was one last big fiery explosion that was provided by Dudley J. LeBlanc, a politician, a salesman, and a medicine show operator who transformed the Bible Belt into the Haddockon Belt. That was the name of his medicine. He parlayed a $2,500 investment into an annual income of $24 million. How his Haddockon business got started was that he had developed a really bad case of gout, and he went to his local doctor who gave him some shots that made him feel better. And so one day when he went to the doctor for his injection, he stole some of it and he took it to a chemist and he had it analyzed, and he realized that it was largely just a solution of various B vitamins. And he went back home and he started mixing up batches of medicine in a big old barrel. You know, people ask him, well, why do you call it Haddockon? And he just said, well, I had to call it something.
If your radiator leaks and your motor stands still, I'll give her Haddockon and watch our boogie up the hill. She'll do the Haddockon boogie. The Haddockon boogie. The Haddockon boogie makes you boogie woogie all the time.
This stuff was so popular, a Louisiana druggist said that they came in to buy Haddockon when they didn't have money to buy food. They had holes in their shoes, and they paid $3.50 for a bottle of Haddockon.
Haddockon, we should bear in mind, was 12% alcohol. When the snake oil peddlers first started out with their potions, doctors had little to offer. But by the time of Haddockon, medicine had really got cracking. We had antibiotics, intensive care. The era of pharmaceutical medicine had begun. It was potent, but it was dangerous. And so health claims were being more tightly regulated. This is where LeBlanc showed his true genius. He was careful to avoid making any specific health claims for Haddockon himself, using testimonials instead from his customers, and spreading the word with a little bit of Hollywood magic.
He decided to put on a show, but not just any show. Now, we're talking about the year 1949, 1950, and what he did was he approached all the big stars of the day. Now, these are people who started out in vaudeville, and first of all, were very used to performing in front of a live audience. We're talking Bob Hope, Jimmy Durante, Carmen Miranda, Minnie Pearl, she was a big country western star, Cesar Romero, Milton Berle, Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney. And they'd go and they'd do one show a day, and they loved it because they were able to get back to their vaudeville roots and perform in front of a live audience. And very, very cleverly, you didn't really need a ticket to the show, you just needed to present a box top from a bottle of Haddockon.
Now there was an old woman who lived in a shoe. Had so many children, she didn't know what to do. She wanted to go out and have a ball.
What happened?
So she bought herself a couple of bottles of Haddockon, Haddockon.
And so, you know, you'd have the band would come on and play, and then you'd have a parade of pretty girls, you'd have a bathing suit contest, then you'd have some fireworks, then you'd have some circus clowns, and then Judy Garland would come out and sing, and then Dorothy Lilmore would do a comedy routine with Bob Hope. I mean, it was a really good show. It was a really good show.
By 1951, the game was up. LeBlanc was spending more on advertising than he made in sales, and the company was going under. But to him, it seems this was all just a game. He appeared on the top-rated TV show You Bet Your Life, hosted by Groucho Marx. Haddockon, said Groucho, what's that good for? Well, said LeBlanc, it was good for $5.5 million for me last year. Just as Haddockon was born in the 1930s, so too was the serious but very young science of nutrition. Much of what we now know today, our basic knowledge about the nutritional value of the food we eat, comes from two fearless scientists. Robert McCants and Elsie Widdowson performed a series of experiments upon themselves in order to prove their hypotheses. And some of it sounds less like science and more like a scene from Trainspotting.
And then you'll remember we went on trying to persuade the body to excrete iron by injecting quite large quantities intravenously into our cells and calcium at the same time. I remember the feelings when the injection of calcium was made too fast. I expect you do too. And I believe it was from those needles that I caught my attack of jaundice.
We thought it was a pity to go to all that trouble of balance experiments just for iron. So we had injections of calcium and magnesium at the same time. We had one needle in our vein with a bit of rubber tubing on the end and three other needles attached to syringes sticking into it.
It was a triumph of the scientists because they used the information that they got, which had been got proper control trials. They devised the rations and they worked fantastically well. And on most criteria, the diet during the war years, and of course things like food rationing went on long after 1945, during the 1940s, the nutritional status of the country was very good.
Ironically, this triumph of nutrition was also sowing the seeds for its decline. John Garrow is Emeritus Professor of Nutritional Science at the University of London.
After the war, there was all sorts of new areas of science opening up, genetics and molecular biology and all that kind of stuff, and nutrition was dismissed by the funding organisations in general. They said, well, you know, what more is there to say? So the 50s and 60s were a Cinderella time for nutrition, and then it became evident that there was actually another problem at the other end of the scale, and that people who were overnourished, i.e. obese, were more liable to have all sorts of diseases, and that people who were overweight tended to die young. And searches went on to see if there was something that could be done about treating or preventing the diseases of affluence.
It's important to remember the historical context for all of this. It was the golden age of medicine, and we were discovering genuine miracles. Antibiotics that would stop you dying from pneumonia at 20, kidney dialysis, intensive care units, transplants, CT scanners, heart surgery and more. And as well as these miracle cures, we really were finding those simple, direct, hidden killers which the media still pine for so desperately in their headlines today. Smoking, to everyone's genuine surprise at the time, turned out to cause 95% of lung cancers. And this became the paradigmatic epidemiological discovery. Simple and unambiguous, smoking causes cancer. Stop people smoking and you can save their lives. Buoyed by this one-to-one relationship between a risk exposure and a risk outcome, we set about hunting for more. Professor Sir Richard Doll, one of the leading researchers on smoking and health, confidently asserted in his book, The Causes of Cancer, that 70% of it would turn out to be caused by food. But there was a problem. Having confidently announced that lifestyle and diet were the business of doctors, the stuff of science, we set about looking for the evidence, and it wasn't as certain as the story on cigarettes had encouraged us to believe. Susan Jebb is a nutrition scientist at the Medical Research Council's Human Nutrition Research Unit in Cambridge.
There is absolutely no doubt that the evidence has continued to accumulate that the lifestyle that we lead, including our diet, but also physical activities, smoking habits, etc., is a critical determinant of our long-term health. And more importantly, it's a modifiable component of our long-term health. That said, I think there perhaps was over-enthusiasm in terms of believing the magnitude of change one could achieve. The fact is that most diseases have a much more complex, multifactorial etiology. So the association between smoking and lung cancer is a much tighter, much less complicated relationship than the causes of coronary heart disease. And so if we're looking at heart disease, actually there are many, many more factors which are important. And I think we've increasingly come to recognise that genetic susceptibility is a part of that. And so there is a limit to how much change we can hope to achieve, certainly by adjusting single risk factors, single dietary factors, but indeed even if we put all the behaviour change together.
The key problem was this. We can observe that two different groups of people have different diets and that they have different health outcomes, different rates of various diseases. These are observational studies. But there'll be lots of other differences between these two groups, social class, exercise. And this is where you need clear thinking, to tease apart the role of food from the role of those other factors. For that, you might want to do intervention studies, where you change diet and then later go back and measure the change in someone's health. But these are hard to do, and the results have generally been disappointing.
Observational studies are very common in nutrition and often involve many, many thousands of people studied over long periods of time. Here we take a large group, measure their diet at the beginning, and then follow their health over the subsequent years and look to see whether they develop high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or perhaps even die of coronary heart disease or cancer. And it's really on these studies that most of the general nutrition information is based. The advice to maintain a healthy body weight, to eat less saturated fat, more fruit and vegetables, less salt and more fibre.
I guess the most obvious kind of gold standard is the intervention study, but it's quite unusual to find those, isn't it?
Good dietary intervention studies are few and far between because they're incredibly difficult to do for a whole host of reasons. Firstly, you really want to change just one component of the diet. That's hard to do because it tends to have knock-on effects to other things. Secondly, you'd ideally like people not to know which bit of the diet they were changing so that you don't build in expectations about health benefits. That's tricky because mostly people know what they're eating. You'd then like them to do it for really quite a long period of time. Yet there's no way, we have enough difficulty recruiting volunteers into studies which last a few weeks or months. They're not going to commit to being in a study for their whole life. Even if they do commit to it, the likelihood that they're going to be able to follow the specific advice you've given them absolutely rigorously is asking a huge amount. So for a whole collection of reasons, dietary intervention studies are hard to do. There are few of them, and they're generally not the place to make your career as an academic scientist.
And they also often have slightly disappointing results because of the problems that you described.
I think it's fair to say that dietary intervention studies generally do not show as big an effect as we tend to predict from so-called observational studies. And there are a lot of reasons why that might be the case. In part, it's because your intervention group, who you ask to make dietary changes, with the best will in the world, often find it hard to make that change consistently over long periods of time, so they don't change quite as much as you'd like them to. Meanwhile, the control group, who you expect to just carry on with their usual diet, tend to change a little bit because most of the things we're studying are also the things where there are lots of public health messages.
So the control group, just because they're in an experiment, pay extra attention to having a healthy lifestyle?
Absolutely. If you volunteer to take part in a nutrition intervention study, you come into our laboratory, you have lots of detailed measurements, you spend several hours talking to our nutritionists, it's probable that that has some impact on your life.
This failure of nutritional research to show clear causal relationships between diet and disease, despite the earlier promises from the world of medicine, has had some fascinating side effects. Firstly, the media demands certainty, as perhaps do we all. So foods are presented as miracle cures or sinister hidden threats, much like smoking really was. Bacon will kill you, chocolate prevents heart attacks, or is it red wine? The very subtle, tenuous relationships between food and possible health outcomes are over-dramatised to the point of foolishness. But our high expectations of the evidence have also contributed to the rise of a new generation of food faddists. Many of them offer certainty, with clear didactic statements and very specific, sciencey-sounding advice on food and health, which often simply isn't supported by the evidence. This has led to frustration and almost embarrassment among genuine academics like Tom Sanders, Professor of Nutrition at King's College London.
The danger is of the nutritional therapy, nutritionism, is actually they're hijacking the agenda. They're taking it away from what is a rather systematic approach that will lead to incremental improvements in nutrition. And this is what I call sort of the Nutribabble that comes across in the media, that there is some sort of magic formula that if you follow this formula, you'll somehow reach nirvana, you'll get heaven. And so what has happened? You've had people coming in, offering them quick fixes, rather like insurance salesmen. And so here's a pill, take the pill, don't have to change your lifestyle or diet, this will deliver all the goods. And one of the big lies that's promoted by alternative health practitioners is that modern food processing has actually removed all the nutrients from foods, and therefore we have to take supplements to make up the shortfall of nutrients in food. Food has never been better in quality than it is now, because it reaches the market much faster. It's preserved by less severe processes than used to be used in the past. For example, people used to have tinned or salted vegetables in the past. Now we're typically either fresh or frozen vegetables. They actually have a higher nutritional value. But the message that has been given out by nutritional therapists is that you need pills to eat healthily. So it's sort of almost a new religion. They're the new evangelists, they're nutritional evangelists. And the problem I have is actually being a scientist, I'm very cynical about everything I see. And, you know, you do experiments and you hope something is going to work and it turns out not to work. And things don't turn out always as you plan. And you learn as a scientist to live with uncertainty and you work out what likelihood is. For the nutritional therapists, they know, they believe.
The good side is that everybody wants to talk about nutrition. It's a real hot topic and there are lots of opportunities to talk to people about food and why it matters. The downside is that it's very hard for the generally dull, conventional nutrition messages to get to the top of the agenda when they're being squeezed out by what seem like much more attractive, much more glamorous, interesting, exciting options being offered by some less evidence-based nutritionists.
In the past, as we have seen, there was a vast industry of miracle potions and lifestyle gurus. It wasn't based in science because science itself knew nothing about food. But now a picture has begun to emerge. Everyone agrees that basic healthy lifestyle advice is important. Eat your greens, get more exercise. But do today's lifestyle nutritionists speak beyond this evidence in offering us the certainty and quick fixes we desire? In the next programme, we'll use the tools of science in which they profess to be experts to examine their sales pitches. Do they use research appropriately? Or do they merely adopt a cloak of scientific authority?
The Rise of the Lifestyle Nutritionist was presented by Ben Goldacre and produced by Rami Zabar. In a moment, Crossing Continents looks at a number of powerful women in Egypt and their struggle to change a repressive society. That's after this.
1968. Myth or reality?
I can just take off and go places.
I shall intend in the House of Commons to raise hell in no mean way.
First time shot, and it's there! Great goal by Bobby Charlton!
First time in Vietnam, an elephant is about to fly.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord!
1968, day by day. On BBC Radio 4, every day, at 5 minutes to five.
And now, Crossing Continents. Bill Law meets a new generation of Egyptian women at the forefront of the struggle.